Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. This is the programme where we bring Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate, conversations that matter every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. It's part of our Range of Faith Explored programmes every Saturday and, of course, available around the world as a podcast. Lots of people download it in all corners of the globe. You can find out more about the show at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there to various resources, Unbelievable Conference DVDs from this year, videos, articles, and of course the Unbelievable book, Why? After 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. It's the story of this programme and why I believe Christianity still makes sense after hosting all of these conversations and debates and dialogues and objections with atheist speakers over the years. Now, if you order it today, as in Saturday or very soon after you hear this podcast, if you listen to it right off the bat, you might still just about get the book in time for Christmas if you're thinking of ordering it as a present for someone. So you can try and do that and see if it arrives. We hope it will. But if you'd like to find out more and order the book, signed copies, of course, available there. Unbelievablebook.co.uk is the place to go. And before we get into the subject of today's Unbelievable, where I'm going to be talking to the co-hosts of a new podcast called Hinge, one's a Christian and one's an atheist, let me tell you about some of the great stuff coming up on Unbelievable in the new year. Yes, we've got loads of great shows for you because this is very much what we're about, is creating interesting conversations. And so it's often just about finding the right people on the right topic. We've got going to have a debate on apologetics generally between Myron B. Penner, who was author of a book called The End of Apologetics, questioning the whole project, really, of rational inquiry in apologetics versus revelation. And Sean McDowell, who, with his father, Josh McDowell, has penned a new version of Evidence That Demands a Verdict, really a classic apologetics book. So they're going to be talking about the value of apologetics. We're going to be debating street epistemology. Pasco Rapace is a street epistemologist. If you're not sure what that is, you'll find out on the programme. But effectively, it's a sort of evangelistic atheism, you could say, where, you know, people will approach others on the street and ask them to defend their faith and explain why they don't believe they've got good reasons for believing. Well, Cameron Bertuzzi will be our Christian apologist on that show, engaging with Pasco on street epistemology. And then we've got two great shows in the new year as well on The Crucifixion of the Warrior God. That's a major new theological work by Greg Boyd, who's well known as a pastor and theologian, often of a controversial variety for his views on things like open theism. But his major new work, in a sense, is probably going to cause even more controversy as he unpacks his hermeneutic, his cruciform hermeneutic, on how to understand and interpret passages of violence and warfare, especially in the Old Testament. Well, he's going to be engaging with Paul Copan, who's a well-known Christian philosopher and apologist who has done a lot of work in that area himself, but takes a very different view on how to understand warfare and violent passages in the Old Testament. So you'll be hearing a two-part special of their conversation in the new year, talking about and debating Greg's new book, The Crucifixion of the Warrior God. And there's other shows in the pipeline as well. Lots of good stuff for 2018. Also some exciting events happening. I'll be out in Canada from the 2nd to 3rd of March at the Apologetics Canada conference going on near Vancouver. So if you're in that direction, I'd love to see you there. I'll be talking about Unbelievable, the book, and why I'm a Christian after 10 years of talking with atheists and talking on a couple of other issues as well, hosting a debate on the opening night of the conference. So If you can, do get along there if you're a listener out in the west side of Canada. Apologetics Canada conference happening 2nd to 3rd of March. And then, of course, our own Apologetics conference here in London. Unbelievable, the conference 2018 happens Saturday the 19th of May. That's the date to ring fence in your diary. If you can make it, we'd love to see you there. We always have a fantastic time with hundreds of guests at the conference. We'll be back at our usual stomping ground of the brewery in central London. And we'll be partnering with Reasons to Believe this year. Hugh Ross and a number of other Reasons to Believe scholars will be flying in from the USA to join us. Loads of other great guests, including Glenn Scrivener. He's actually going to be on the show next week. Andy Bannister returns and a number of other brilliant guests. Sharon Dirks from Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, Rob Parsons and Catherine Hill from Care for the Family, talking about this sort of pastoral side of people who walk away from the faith and that kind of thing. So loads of really interesting topics, seminars. We'll have our youth stream running again. Look out for that. Early in 2018, we'll be giving you more details and how to book in for this year's conference. Unbelievable, the conference, Saturday the 19th of May. Also excited to announce we're going to be working on some unique programming in 2018 on big questions around science, faith, philosophy, technology, what it means to be human, with the generous support of the Templeton Religion Trust. We're going to be inviting high-profile guests from across the faith spectrum on programmes themed around things like artificial intelligence, evolution and morality, cosmology, neuroscience and free will, meaning in a secular age, the psychology of belief. It's going to be fantastic. We're going to have a really fantastic time exploring those conversations in the coming year. So lots to look forward to on the show that aims to get those big conversations going generally, and I'm really looking forward to what's going on today's programme. A little later on, in the final part of today's show, I'm also going to be speaking to Jared McKenna, who's an Australian pastor and activist, about some adventures he's been having on an island with a detention centre off the coast of Australia. So listen out in the last part of today's programme for that. You're unbelievable. But today's conversation on the show involves playing out the first episode of a brand new podcast. Someone else has a great new show out there online called Hinge, which in many ways is a progeny of The Unbelievable Show. You'll be finding out why during the course of the episode we're about to air. And I'll be speaking to Drew Sokol and Corey Markham, the co-hosts of the show, later on in today's programme. So for now, sit back and listen to Hinge.
Hinge is brought to you by Curious Media and over 100 people who contributed to make it happen. If you are interested in becoming part of the Hinge team, visit hingepodcast.org.
I didn't realize when it was happening how big it was when Drew was going through it initially. I think I put it up more to nerves at the time. The paper bag was a little off-putting. that I forget.
Did you notice that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, like Drew's been kind of like looking sick and terrible, but you had this paper bag that you were either throwing up in or hyperventilating with or doing a little bit of both. Man. And then it comes up on stage with him, put it on a table that was on the stage in it. So I was like, awesome.
I totally forgot I had it in my hand.
My name is Corey Markham. That was my friend and co-host Drew Sokol with his friend Jeremy. They were processing an event in Drew's life that was comical, but that also called a lot of his life, his career, life goals, even his relationships, all into question. This is Hinge, a show about doubt, identity, and the search for the real Jesus. For 10 episodes, Drew and I are sharing with you a journey we've been on for the last year. But this episode, I'm starting us with this turning point in Drew's life.
So I'm standing on stage in this big auditorium. There's this bottom level and a top level, bright lights on me, 800 people staring back at me. You know that I'm a pastor, so this is pretty standard stuff. And I was 10 minutes into my sermon when I had this feeling come over me like, I can't do this anymore.
Wow.
So about a week earlier, I'd gotten this email from a friend saying that she had just been diagnosed with terminal cancer. She was a single mom with two young daughters, and I could hardly believe it. I was like, are you kidding me? And so, of course, I immediately went to see her, and I remember I parked the car across the street, and as I'm walking up to the building, I can already hear her moaning in pain from up on the third floor, and her two daughters were just sitting there at the kitchen table doing their homework. They barely flinched because this had become the new norm for them. And I remember I just prayed with them. Yeah, I was praying that God's love is real, that he is good, that he showed this through the life of Jesus, but But the whole time I was thinking, is there really this good and loving God when this mom and her two daughters are suffering like this?
Yeah.
So that's what led up to that moment preaching on stage.
Because one conversation that's happening in our culture right now is actually on this topic of truth. We ask as a culture, we ask, what is truth? And how can I experience something that's true? And how can I find something that will always be true?
And I wanted to say, look, whatever you're facing, this is the answer in your search for truth. God himself in history came down to earth. He lived, he died, he rose from the dead. And that's how we can know that there's this plan behind everything. In fact, it's that story that had held up my faith.
Yeah.
But in that moment, this thought overwhelmed me. I've seen too many people suffer like that single mom, and I got this sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach, and I started to think, none of this can be real. Like, this feels fake to me. I'm a liar. I've been lying to myself, I'm lying to all these people right now, and I have no desire to finish this sermon. But I did. On the outside, I held it together, but on the inside, I was having a complete existential crisis. You know, as a pastor, it's my job to have answers, and I felt in this moment like I don't have the answers. Finally, after what felt like forever, I finished the sermon, but as soon as I got off the stage, man, I was in tears. I went to the bathroom, and I just threw up.
Wow.
For the rest of the service, I had to keep this paper bag nearby just in case. But I realized I don't believe this anymore.
Drew's story reminded me of something I once felt, even though that feeling eventually would take our lives in two very different directions.
I remember waking up one morning to the front door, someone knocking, and then my buddy answered the door. And the first thing I feel is I'm annoyed because I'm like, I hate being woken up. But I remember hearing my neighbor, he told my friend that had answered the door, he told him that one of my really good friends had died the night before in a car accident.
Wow.
This would probably be 2 days after all that happened. I had met up with maybe 30 or 40 of my friends at a soccer field. It's called Eastside Center in East Peoria, Illinois. And it was really, it was rainy and cloudy outside. And I remember standing there, there's like 30 or 40 of us in a giant circle holding hands. The grass was wet and everyone was praying. Everyone was looking up at the sky, praying to God. And I think I probably had lost my faith in God sometime before that, but that was certainly the first time where on an introspective level, I was aware of the fact that I didn't believe in God anymore. I'm not gonna lie, it was a really like lonely moment. Because I felt as though I was one of the only people that really appreciated how tragic it was. Because everyone else there seemingly believed that she wasn't really gone and that she was in a better place, you know, happily ever after and so on. But for me, she was gone. There was no future for her. Like, her life had been cut short at 16 years old in a stupid, random, pointless car accident.
How close did you come to leaving?
Real close. You know, I didn't tell anyone, but I actually interviewed for a couple of jobs because I just didn't want to be a pastor anymore. I spent probably 6 to 8 months really wrestling with what I believed. And I was starting to hate this feeling that my whole life was built on something that I couldn't see, that I couldn't touch, that I couldn't feel. But at the same time, most of my closest friends are believers, and I was afraid that if I left the faith, that they'd be gone. Not that they'd abandon me, but that our friendships would just erode. You know, maybe I wouldn't just have to start a new career from scratch, but a whole new life from scratch. And what if I wasn't successful in either?
So here's what happened. Drew regained his faith for reasons we'll be unpacking as we go through the series. He's still a pastor, and I'm still an atheist. But that's actually the whole reason why we're friends. Because around that time, Drew heard me on a podcast called Unbelievable, debating the topic of intelligent design. He then contacted me through a Facebook message, and in that message he wrote, "Who has any interest in living out a lie?" That sort of brutal honesty, especially coming from a pastor, took me by surprise, and we quickly built up a friendship, mostly based on our opposite beliefs. Drew thinks there must be a God who created the universe. I don't. He thinks there's a good response to all of the suffering in the world. I certainly don't. But as complex and nuanced as those kinds of debates can get, here's what's funny about Christianity. It all kind of turns on this straightforward claim of history, that God literally became a man, lived, died, and then rose from the dead, all at a specific time and place in history. If this did happen, maybe there's reason for some kind of hope. But if it didn't happen, then maybe that hope is just a pretty invention. So here's the journey Drew and I have been on for the last year. By January, we had both quit our jobs, moved to the East Coast, and started a full-scale inquiry into the enigma that is the Jesus of history. And throughout, our main question has been this. What are the actual facts? What literally actually happened 2,000 years ago?
The only thing a historian can say is that at least Paul and probably some other earliest disciples of Jesus believed they saw him somewhere, sometime after his death.
This is Dr. Dale Martin. He just retired as a historian at Yale.
I've spent a lifetime trying to argue that the Jesus of faith is not the historical Jesus. I believe Jesus was a lower class worker, probably working in some kind of trade. He was born and raised in Nazareth, probably around the time of his mid-20s or 30. He was probably not married. He had no intention of founding a new religion. It does seem like that when he went around, he went around gathering other young men and some women as his followers. And I think that's historical that he did choose 12 to be sort of be his special inner circle.
Interesting, but maybe not something for a modern day person to build their life on. Why did people believe this man was actually God?
So the miracles, if they didn't really happen, why were they absorbed into the community and why weren't they dismissed off the bat?
Well, because people wanted to believe them. The need to have hope in suffering is why a lot of people are believers. It's actually the suffering and the need for hope that inspires their faith. The disciples somehow believed that he still was the Messiah. And in fact, I believe that maybe whatever they experienced as seeing the resurrected Jesus, that we could say is the catalyst to the beginning of Christianity.
So if whatever the disciples saw was the catalyst to Christianity, why not at least consider the possibility that it was a miracle? Well, it turns out the answer to that question is more about what the rules of history should be.
What can a modern historian say about the historical Jesus and not lose tenure? You can't say Jesus is divine if you're a modern historian. We can't say, for example, that the resurrection of Jesus is a historical fact. Nobody who accepts modern science can accept that.
Huh.
A lot of stories about people seeing Elvis in a McDonald's after his death were all over the place. You know, I remember this. Was there any modern historian who went around trying to investigate that? No. If you investigated it, what you're going to investigate is how did this story rise? Who believes this and why do they believe it? What does it tell us culturally? But you're not going to try to use it to prove that Elvis rose from the dead. That's just against the rules.
But not every historian agrees it's against the rules.
He died on the cross. He made extraordinary claims about himself. And our best early sources say that the tomb was empty and that his disciples saw him again. I would say that is the witness of history.
This is Dr. Gary Habermas. He is the chair of philosophy and theology at Liberty University, but perhaps more importantly, he is widely regarded as one of the foremost experts on the history of Jesus' life.
I've spent years doing this. I think I've studied this topic more than anybody else in the world has.
Over the course of 30 years, he consulted over 3,500 scholarly works, discussed the historical Jesus with close to 100 scholars, and contributed to over 100 books, all towards sharpening his own expertise. And he started to notice, when it comes to the events surrounding the main miracle claim, the resurrection, historians, Christian or not, actually agree about a lot.
I start with the crucifixion. Not because the crucifixion has anything to do with the resurrection, except that you have to have a dead man before you talk about a resurrected man. All right, second. Later, the disciples had experiences that they believed, they were totally convinced, were appearances of the risen Jesus.
Right.
The disciples were willing to die. Willing to die means you put yourself repeatedly in the line of fire, and you keep going back into the war zone, even though you know that friends of yours have been killed, persecutions have occurred because you're so convinced that the message you have is true.
But this is where it gets the most surprising.
This message was taught very, very early. are evidences for some of the world's greatest events. Caesar crossing the Rubicon, Alexander the Great's life is not what people think they are. Hmm. The earliest source for Alexander is almost 300 years later. That's like Buddha, where the best sources for Buddha are 300 to 500 years later.
In other words, a lot of the history that we just take for granted as being, well, history, Alexander the Great, Buddha, rely upon sources that were made hundreds of years after the fact.
So when I say we have an early creed that goes 1 year from the cross, the contrast is just incredible.
Okay, so there's a creed about the resurrection within a year. And within 15 years, a contemporary Paul is writing that 500 people saw Jesus after he rose, all at the same time. In other words, whether the resurrection happened or not, the earliest Christians certainly believed it did. What's the best explanation here? This is where historians part ways. Habermas would say that the only real conclusion is that this man literally rose from the dead. But
we're still really just dealing with these claims. Does that make sense? I mean, am I being too skeptical, perhaps?
No, I don't think anything is too skeptical, because been there and done that. I think it's because Christianity has such incredibly good evidence that we are put up against the finest sifting sand, where I have 18 non-Christian sources for Jesus within about 150 years. Non-Christian. Then you have the Christian ones. Then you have the canonical Christian ones. Then you have the non-Christian canonical ones. Then you have archaeology. There's almost nobody in the ancient world that we have that kind of data for. Your only objection is, yeah, but miracles don't happen.
It's true that this is what it often comes down to. Can we take miracle claims seriously or not? If this weren't a miracle claim, historians probably wouldn't even be debating it. It would just be widely accepted as historical canon. But that's the problem. It is a miracle claim.
So, what's your reaction so far?
Actually, frustration. I don't think it makes sense to just dismiss miracles offhand, because I don't know that miracles can't happen.
So let me get this straight. The idea of a miracle isn't a barrier to you?
No, it's a huge barrier, but I just don't think we should rule it out. It's still a crazy claim to me, though.
What do you think it would take for you to believe?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, because whenever I really try to imagine a hypothetical piece of evidence, say, or maybe some sort of personal experience that would somehow convince me that I'm wrong about all this and actually make me believe, whenever I try to imagine that, I immediately can then envision myself being skeptical about it, like, pretty quickly thereafter. And so I think the truth is that I don't know what it would take to convince me and make me believe. I really don't know. What about you? Would you give up your belief if it could be shown none of this happened?
In a heartbeat. Well, maybe not that fast, and not that it wouldn't be hard, but if you take away the history piece, it would all feel like a Jenga set. It would all just fall apart.
Are you really convinced that that's true?
Yeah. If it could be shown that none of this happened.
So, like, you're saying that you wouldn't be a staunch Christian.
Right.
Like, but I have a hard time imagining that you would just... Because, like, you wouldn't just go from that to an atheist. And, like, you'd still believe in some sort of God or something, right? Like,
I mean, I have a hard time imagining that all this came from nothing, but I wouldn't have any idea what caused it or who caused it.
So that would be enough?
Because I would feel like we wouldn't have any way to know. Again, I think it'd be really, really tough.
It's like you're hanging your hat all on Jesus.
I think I am.
Okay.
What would it take for one of us to change our minds? And what are the real reasons behind our beliefs? Those are the questions we're wrestling with, and it's what this show is all about. Examining our beliefs. And that means being open to the possibility that we're wrong. One way we've talked about this whole journey is like a road in front of us that disappears into a fog. We've stumbled some, bumped into each other a few times, but we've also taken some steps forward. And the hope is that the further we journey down this road together, the more the fog will begin to clear, and we'll begin to see who this man really was. But you want to know what I think? I don't think the road leads to anywhere special. What if the only thing at the end of the road is just more fog? Drew and I are eager to share our journey with you over 10 episodes. We've got lots of questions to dig into. Why was Jesus so cryptic?
Throughout, God almost stacks the odds against himself. He makes it hard to believe, not easy to believe.
What's the reason his followers might have had to exaggerate who he was?
It helped him come to terms with the idea that crucifixion is a shameful death.
And what if it's all not true?
I am free falling into an abyss, but I'm not going to hit the bottom hard because Jesus will help me out. He didn't.
Along the way, we tackle the supposed claims of Jesus.
I'm a psychiatrist, so I see people who believe that they themselves are the Messiah. And when people say that, we put them in a psychiatric hospital.
We wrestle with what role emotions and personal experiences should play.
You know, I found peace in the idea that when awful things happen, there's not a good God who has the ability to change, because that is hurtful to me. It's way more soothing to think there just isn't a God.
We even tackle this whole miracles question and investigate some actual miracle claims.
I know that I know when Rebecca came in and she put her hand on me, just like that, my spirit came back in my body. My little daughter raised me from the dead.
But next, the main reason that I'm not convinced. Thank you for listening, and go check out the next episode of Hinge on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. It's already available.
Production is by Fraser McCulloch. Music is by Ben Mason. I'm Alex Scott. Hinge is the first podcast of Curious Media, a media production nonprofit. The mission of Curious is to tell stories that captivate us with the big questions in life. If you would like to support Curious and help make the rest of Hinge and future podcasts a reality, visit hingepodcast.org and click on support.
That was the first episode of the Hinge podcast, just released this last week. Episode 2 now available via iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'd love you to rate it and leave a review, or find out more about it at hingepodcast.org. And on the other side of a short break, I'm going to be speaking to Drew and Corey about the project.
Believers and non-believers will all be helped, says Tim Keller, a wonderfully clear and accessible case for Christianity. From a man who has hosted many of the world's most prominent skeptics and atheists, says Andrew Wilson. Beautifully written, brilliantly argued, will thrill and challenge, says R.T. Kendall. Unbelievable the Book by Justin Brierley. Download a free chapter and find out how it can help you make the case for Christ. Unbelievablebook.co.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to this week's edition of the Unbelievable radio show and podcast, where we bring Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us about anything you hear on the show to feedback. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. If you want to send in an email, you can also tweet me or Facebook me too about the show. At UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. If you want to get in touch via the Facebook page, and indeed follow the show for updates and interesting articles that I post there from time to time. Later on in today's program, we're going to be hearing from a friend of the show. Jared McKenna is an Australian pastor, thinker, and social justice activist. He's got an amazing track record of holding the authorities in Australia to account over their record on refugees and asylum seekers. Well, he's been on some adventures recently to do with the Manus Island Detention Centre. He'll be telling us about that towards the end of today's programme. Not something we normally cover on the show, where we tend to keep it in the realm of theology and apologetics and that kind of thing. But I was so struck, really, by Jared's latest adventures and story that I really wanted to make sure we heard about it on the Unbelievable show. So I hope you'll be able to listen for that towards the end of today's programme. But today on the show, our main conversation is between Corey Markham and Drew Sokol. One is an atheist, one's a Christian, and they're the co-hosts of a new podcast called Hinge. In the first part of today's show, we heard the first episode, and you can go and download the second episode right now. But I do have a little confession to make before we hear from Corey and Drew, which is that after recording our conversation, due to a technical error on my part, unfortunately, the first 10 minutes or so of our conversation was lost. where I introduced Corey and Drew, talked about the genesis of the Hinge podcast, talked about why they called it Hinge, and talked about the link it has with the Unbelievable show. So unfortunately, you won't be hearing the very first part of our conversation, which also involved Drew talking again about his crisis of faith that you heard about in the episode itself. So what we're doing is we're leaping into sort of halfway through the conversation, and this is where I start to talk to Corey Markham, the atheist co-host of the show, about what it would take to get him to come to belief. Coming back to you, Corey, one of the interesting parts towards the end of that first episode that we heard was that question, is there anything that might convince you or bring you closer to believing Christianity is true? And you said it was very hard to think of anything because your skeptical faculties would sort of immediately take over and make you question anything that did. I just wanted to pursue that a bit further, though, because it's a question I often ask of my skeptical and atheist guests here. And again, it's very similar to you. Because it's a hypothetical, they struggle to think of anything that would convince them. But I don't know, what kind of do you envision any kind of area of evidence or thing that if it turned out, you know, that happened, then potentially, yes, that would be a point on the side of Christianity or theism as opposed to atheism?
Yeah. So the interesting thing, like, I can imagine a personal experience, but it would have to be really specific for me to connect it to Christianity specifically, right? So I can imagine myself having some sort of experience that means that there's something beyond, say, the natural world. But it would be another step for me to connect that with the Christian worldview. Now, that said, I do think, as you said, you asked this question a lot, and obviously I've been asked it before as well, and I'm going to be asked it plenty of times in the future. I do have an answer, a more specific answer, and even it's a historical evidence answer, and I've talked to Drew about this before. Like, one thing, and I don't know if this would just absolutely convince me, but it would be really, really interesting if, instead of just having this James and Paul, these outsiders, if you will, or I guess a skeptics and outsider, instead of just having those two having these conversions and writing down their experiences of a risen Jesus, if you will, what if we uncovered some collection of text which basically told us that Jesus also appeared to the Sanhedrin. You know, he appeared to a bunch of other outsiders, a bunch of other Jewish people at the time, say, and that all these people were convinced as well. And then for whatever reason, that was just lost to history. That would be, it's already remarkable, I should say, that we have this from Paul and from James. James, the brother of Jesus, and Paul, this at one point, the persecutor of Christianity. But it would be really incredible if you had a hundred, say, plus other outsiders that had experience that converted as a result. Now, I my caveat is that, again, that's not to say that if we uncover that and then I learned about that I would suddenly be a Christian.
Of course.
But that would be really interesting. And I think a lot of secular historians themselves would at least make them pause. It would be hard because they'd have more work to do to try to explain that. Yeah.
I mean, you started to get into in that towards the end of that episode again, that subject we've done a few times on Unbelievable as well when discussing the resurrection of is a miracle allowed when it comes to the historical evidence, as it were, and the limits of what history allows and so on. I mean, are you in principle open yourself, Corey, to the idea that the evidence around the story of the resurrection could be explained by a miracle if the evidence points in that direction, or do you side with the Crossleys and the Ehrmans who say that's not within the province of history to posit those kinds of supernatural events?
Yes. Yeah, so with the obvious disclaimer that I'm not a historian or an expert, and so I feel a bit silly comparing my opinions to theirs. I mean, I do disagree. I don't think that we should close ourselves off to the possibility of miracles. More specifically, some of your listeners will know. I mean, I don't consider myself a metaphysical naturalist I hate to say it, but in the sort of presuppositionalist sense, that I don't presuppose that naturalism is true and that supernaturalism is false, and therefore therefore, any explanation or answer is going to therefore just be a natural explanation. You just have to figure it out. I don't think I don't take that approach. At the same time, I do think it's I understand the reservations for the very same reasons that scientists have methodological naturalism. I'm sure it makes sense on some level to take a similar approach with respect to history, in that we should always try to seek out natural explanations whenever we can. But we shouldn't rule supernatural explanations out altogether. I don't know enough about the world to do that, if that makes sense.
Drew, I think you're wanting to come in and say something as well.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I think one thing Corey and I have talked about quite a bit is he's theoretically open to it. But I think Corey, kind of an interesting question is, what would it actually take, going back to the similar question you asked before, Justin, like, what would it actually take for you to believe a miracle happened? Like, within that framework of having this personal experience yourself, I can imagine you doubting that. I can imagine you still having tons of questions. Or even if you saw that evidence of the Sanhedrin that you mentioned, like, I can still hear your voice in my head now saying, well, that's still just a claim. We don't know that it actually happened. It's just a claim that we found that the 100 Sanhedrin converted or something like that.
Yeah. So a miracle, I can tell you guys right now, and you probably heard this, something similar to this before, Justin, if Jesus appeared to not just me, but he appeared to everyone, everyone that had a TV, say, everyone that was watching TV at one moment, and even people who weren't watching TV, people were just hanging out, reading a book, tweeting, like the if he just appeared to all of them and gave them all, me as well, the same message, I think that my skepticism at that point, if I was skeptical, that would be irrational, because the most obvious explanation was that indeed a miracle had occurred. I'm sorry, I know that's sort of like a trite answer, because that's sort of the...
Well, no.
But at the same time, I don't personally think that's too much to ask for, because if insofar that God, it's within our interest to be in a relationship with this loving, good God, well, then it seems reasonable to me to, you know, to expect something like that. And no more ambiguity in gray area, you know.
It's an interesting one, because it's always something we've covered before on the show, and I've always wondered. It leads you into that whole question of can God almost, are there reasons why God wouldn't want to overwhelm people with such evidence of his existence, in as much as God may have other reasons for wanting people to search for him in ways that, where he's not simply almost forcing them to believe in him by doing something. We don't have time to get into that, but it is a fascinating whole area.
Justin, if I can make one quick point on that, I do think it's important that people recognize, if they're really readers of the Gospels, to say that that kind of action would be inconsistent with the kind of character that we see out of Jesus himself. Because there are so many times that Jesus speaks in parables, and the disciples will ask him later, why are you speaking in parables? Why not just make it clear? And he basically says, so that some people will believe and so that some people for the time now won't. And we don't know all the reasons why he would approach it that way, but that kind of action would be inconsistent with the Jesus of the Gospels.
It's an interesting point. Who knows, one that maybe will get explored later on in the Hinge. But the one level, Drew, obviously you are both on a journey looking at the evidence here for the historical Jesus. Again, I don't want you to give away spoilers necessarily, but in general, would you say that what you've uncovered in the course of obviously the interviews you've done, the preparation you've done for these podcasts, has caused more doubts in your mind about it, has helped you? Do you find yourself in a similar position to where you were when you started this journey?
You know, it's interesting. I actually would say, I'm curious to see how Corey responds to this. I would actually say part of the reason that I had that really overwhelming season of doubt is that I had been a pastor for a couple of years at that point, and my entire life had become just surrounded by Christians. And so I never really had consistent opportunities to juxtapose my worldview with other worldviews. And what I found for me is that the truth of the Christian worldview as I see it stands out to me when I am consistently interacting with people of other worldviews. It becomes much more satisfying to me when I can compare and contrast it. And I think for me, it's actually you know, we're working on episode 3 right now as we speak. And so there's still a long journey to go. I don't want to pretend as if we know how it's going to end. We know how it's going to end. We're both trying to stay open-minded to this. I think a lot of people, when I talk to skeptics, they'll say what they want is evidence. You know, I just want evidence, God to reveal himself to some degree. But then when you really press them, you find out that what they're talking about isn't evidence, but proof. And I think a lot of people do have this expectation that if God is good and loving, then he's clearly going to reveal himself to everybody in a sense that it's undeniable, in a sense that, as the word you used, overwhelming. But that you know, that presupposes that we have some sense as to if there is this God that's so far beyond anything we could ever imagine, that he created this universe that's so complex that, you know, we only have like the slightest hint of how it was potentially formed. That presupposes that we know how he would act and what his plan would be. And to me, that seems to be a pretty significant stretch. I'm pretty willing to grant that if this God is real, that he would act in ways that I wouldn't expect. And so I think for me, I find the Christian worldview to be more and more satisfying, actually, the more I interact with skeptics.
We'll come back to you, Corey, for your take on that in just a moment's time. We're going to go to a quick break, and we'll be finishing up this conversation with the two co-hosts of the new Hinge podcast, which you heard in the first part of today's program, the first episode of, and which you're very welcome to go and subscribe to on iTunes or wherever you find your podcast. Look for Hinge, and you'll be treated to more quality episodes as they as Drew and Corey go on this journey together as an atheist and a Christian, looking into the historical Jesus and the claims of Christianity. So check that out. Make sure there are links, of course, from today's show as well. But you can find that at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, on today's show, we've been talking to the creators and co-hosts of a new podcast called Hinge. They are Drew Sokol and Corey Markham. Drew is the Christian co-host and Corey is the atheist. They've both really met through Unbelievable, so it's nice. It's nice that Unbelievable was responsible for this marriage of minds on the Hinge podcast. But I've really enjoyed the conversation we've had, folks, and I'm really looking forward to personally just to listening to future episodes of Hinge as it continues to draw on both your stories and reactions and the people you're going to be talking to about the historical Jesus and so on. We heard in that last section there, Corey, that Drew was saying for him it has actually been a helpful process in putting the pieces together and being able to engage with, you know, other types of worldview and so on. And you said yourself that you've got a new awareness, certainly, of the evidence that is there for the Christian claims about Christ and so on. But in the process of at least of what you've done so far with the podcast, has it moved you any way in the direction of thinking this is a credible thing? Or do you feel like at this point there's certainly not enough there to make it a sort of a likely candidate, as it were, in terms of the truth or not of it?
Yeah. So paradoxically, as I said, I think I was surprised initially at the type and the amount of evidence that there is for the life of Jesus and for the various claims. But at the same time, because I'm an atheist, I have got my atheist hat on when I'm doing this research and things. At the same time, I've become more confident in my specific criticisms against the Christian worldview, if that makes sense. My views about Jesus, my views about what I think happened are more concrete now because I have a better idea of the events. And so I have a better grasp of what probably happened those 2000 years ago, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird because
I know what you mean. It, maybe before you even really knew much about the area, you only had vague speculative ideas about what might or might not happen. Now that you've looked into it, you've got a better grasp of what we do know and what we don't know, and you're able to make a more sort of considered decision about what happened historically, in your view. I mean, coming back to you then, Drew, I mean, it's interesting to hear Corey say that because it's a classic case of obviously maybe you've got good reasons to see the positive evidence for Christianity. Corey's got his own worldview, which maybe gives him reasons for seeing the negative evidence. Do we end up just kind of, you know, bunkering down in our positions, you know, very often with these things in a kind of almost predetermined way?
Yeah, that's a great question. We definitely don't want to give the perception here that there's no reason to listen to the podcast because we're just going to keep the same views that we had. It's kind of the opposite of what we're going for here. I would say going through this process with Corey, I have come to see the reasons people actually believe, the reasons why I actually believe, the reasons why Corey actually believes the things he does, and same with plenty of other people, in a way that is much more clarifying than I even expected. That there are, no matter how philosophical you are, you start with whatever assumptions you make at the beginning of your argument. There are assumptions that are buried underneath those assumptions, and underneath those assumptions are more assumptions that are buried underneath. And it's these beginning assumptions that guide pretty much everything that we look at. And I think for Corey and I, it's taken a year and a half, 2 years of digging to get to like the deepest assumptions that are guiding the ways that we see the world. And I think part of the journey over the 10 episodes, and we do want to give the impression it is still a journey, because we're only on the third episode right now in terms of production. At the very least, by the end, we're going to come out of it with a sense of like, okay, these are the reasons why people in my life go this direction with their beliefs. These are the reasons why other people go that direction. And I think this is what's guiding me in my own search. And so hopefully that helps people connect and understand other people with a different worldview, in a sense that like, oh, this person's just clearly, you know, their reasoning is wrong, or that's a faulty assumption, or whatever it is. Hopefully it becomes a much more, when we engage in these topics, hopefully it can become, again, much more three-dimensional, where we see the other person is just a human with a very understandable assumption that's guiding the way they look at evidences.
I guess let's just pretend Corey's not on the line right now. But, you know, what would it take, in your view, Drew, to get Corey, you know, to that point almost? Knowing him as a friend, knowing that he's looked at the same evidence you've looked at in this process, but he's come to this point where he's pretty certain it's not going to change his mind. I mean, Corey himself has said it would probably take something like a personal experience that he can't put his finger on at this point because he wouldn't know what that would look like. But in your view, is that, in a sense, you know, joking aside, is that often has to be, in a sense, part of the mix of someone coming to faith? It can't be done purely through the evidence alone. There has to be some sort of an experience to which that evidence is a confirmation, if you like.
Yeah, I kind of have two answers to that question, because even for me, I don't, there's not this overwhelming personal experience that I look back to, and that's a reason why I believe. That's not even part of my own story. The first thing is with regard to that idea that if there really is this good God that's running the world, that he would have goals, he would have ways of doing things that I can't even begin to comprehend. You know, even when you just kind of dip your toes into a little bit of science and you learn things about, you know, my wife is studying to be a nurse practitioner right now, and I've learned crazy things like in the last minute, you know, my body just made something like 100 million new cells or something wild like that. Or like if you were to take all the blood vessels in your body and stretch them out into one line, just from one body, it would go from where I am in Philadelphia right now to Tokyo and back 5 times. Like there's so much complexity in the world that we live in. And if there really is this God that made everything and made it all this way, then he can also have complexity underneath the reasons of why he's running the world the way he is that I can't begin to understand. And so I think on one hand, intellectually, if Corey were ever able to get himself to a point that like, if there is this God, he's going to operate differently than I would expect, I think that would change the way he sees a lot of different things and really change the conversation form around Jesus. But then the second thing, you know, it's kind of interesting. When we were working on our second episode, at one point I used the word attractive, and I'm referring to a specific person and talking about how this specific person made the faith attractive to me. And Corey asked me, like, is that a helpful word? Because people are going to see that's not like a reasonable thing. And I told him, you know, actually, I think it's the perfect word, because I think for the most part, we gravitate not towards the things that are most reasonable. We gravitate towards the things that are most attractive. And I think for Corey, story, you know, I have no idea what the political views and everything of people on the podcast are, but I think a lot of us right now are surrounded by a lot of evangelicals who stand for things that seem antithetical to what we see from the actual Jesus of the Gospels. And I don't know that most of evangelicalism is all that attractive right now. And I think for a lot of skeptical listeners, if they were immersed in communities where people are actually on a day-to-day basis striving to follow Jesus, striving to pursue justice within the neighborhoods that they live in, striving to serve the communities around them, striving to create this kind of counterculture that you see in Acts 2 and all throughout the New Testament. If people were immersed in that and they saw how attractive Christian communities can be when the Spirit is really working, I think that's a game changer. I think it's a lot more powerful than any well-reasoned argument.
I'll leave the last word to you, Corey. In a sense, given that you don't anticipate this changing your mind necessarily, and it would be something along the lines of an unusual experience or whatever that would take you, I guess the question is, why are you doing this? And given that you're probably not expecting it to change Drew's mind either, why go on this journey together? What's the value in it? And what's the value for the listener as well, whether they be Christian or non-Christian, as they follow your journey on the podcast?
That's a great question. I think about this a lot, and I think there's probably, I don't know what a psychiatrist would say. I like to joke about it. It's like, perhaps there's a subconscious motivation for me in that, Drew knows, like I say this a lot, I want to be wrong about my atheism. I'd rather it not be the case that the universe is meaningless and that there's no purpose and that there's no, especially that there's no afterlife. That's probably the biggest one for me. I, as an atheist, I have not, and I probably will not ever grow accustomed to the anxiety and fear that one feels over losing their loved ones and that it could happen at any point randomly. And so on one level, maybe I'm doing this because I want there to be something else. And, you know, that I don't know how else to go about getting to that point other than looking at the evidence and then looking into this stuff. But on another level, I think that, you know, I like to think that this podcast does a few other things. One, I want to better understand my Christian brothers and sisters. And I want them to better understand myself and my fellow atheists and our views. There's a lot of misperceptions and misunderstandings about atheists and about our views. And so that's a big thing that I think listeners might get out of this, is they're going to get a little bit better. Of course, your listeners specifically are going to have far more familiarity with the different respective worldviews than some of the average listeners that are going to be listening to Hinge. But and then another thing, especially in our country, Justin, in the last year or so, the atmosphere, whether it's the political atmosphere or even this religious atmosphere, has become so toxic. It's next to impossible to have meaningful conversations with those that you disagree with about really important topics. And so this podcast for me is also a way for Drew and I to demonstrate that you can have those conversations with people that you disagree with. And moreover, we need to have those conversations. If we want to go forward in the world as a species, as our respective countries and everything, we need to have these conversations about difficult topics that other people don't typically like to talk about. And so, yeah, that's what Hinge is to me and what I think it is and what it can be for the listeners.
Fantastic stuff. Guys, it's been so good having you both on the Unbelievable podcast to talk about your podcast. It's all a bit meta this week, but it's been really fun. I guess at this stage as well, as you're still producing and looking, you know, as to what, how the series will develop over time, still chances for people to give their suggestions and get in touch with their stories and that kind of thing. Is there any way people can get in touch with you guys?
Yeah, I would say if they go to the website, there's contact information for both of us. The email address for our organization is info@curiosmedia.org. But just go to the website. It'll guide you from there.
And what is the website?
Hingepodcast.org.
Hingepodcast.org. Go there, check out more about it, find out more about Drew and Corey, and of course go and subscribe to the podcast if you're a podcast listener, and I'm sure you will enjoy it, and maybe we'll be able to catch up with you guys once the episodes have aired and you've got some time to reflect on it in the future. But for the moment, thanks both for being with me on Unbelievable today.
Yeah,
thanks so much, Justin.
Well, coming up on the final part of today's show, I'm going to be talking to Australian pastor and Christian activist Jared McKenna about his recent adventure smuggling himself onto Manus Island to visit refugees in Australia's controversial detention centre there. Do stay with us for Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. And don't forget, available as a podcast at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. How Santa Stole Christmas. In the latest Premier Christianity magazine, find out how Christians can win Christmas back again from the over-commercialized version the shops sell us. Plus, could artificial intelligence spell the end of the human race? We chart the rise of the robots. Five people whose dreams led them to faith tell their story. Claire Musters shares how a disastrous decision forced her to take off the mask in church and meet John Mark Comer, the pastor to millennials reaching America's most secular city. All that plus much more. Get your free edition at premierchristianity.com/freesample. Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable show here on Premier Christian Radio. As part of Faith Explored and listened to around the world as a podcast, you can join others who do that at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Leave comments on today's show there, find links to the social media, and of course to Unbelievable the Book, which is the story of this show and why I've been hosting these debates between Christians and non-Christians, and why I'm still a Christian at the end of the day. Lots of people ordering that for Christmas, so it's been great to hear of people getting hold of the book in time for the festive season, and also more reviews coming in over the course of the last few weeks. This one from Curious Guy on the Amazon page. Gave it a 5 out of 5. Thank you very much, Mr. Curious Guy, who says, once I realized this book was not a biography of the band EMF, it's a little reference there to the show music we feature at the top of every show, I settled in and enjoyed reading about Justin's experience hosting his radio show for the last 10 years and how it's impacted his faith. As a newer listener to the Unbelievable podcast, which I also recommend highly, I appreciated reading about some of the more memorable interviews and debates, as well as how Justin initially came to faith. Appreciate his honesty on some of the more challenging arguments that atheists have made and how, regardless of such, in the end, his faith experienced an increase. What I appreciate most in a polarized society and the associated hostile social media environment in which we find ourselves is the civility on display and the respect given to those with whom he disagrees. I think we could all take a lesson in that, regardless of our beliefs. Possibly my new favourite intro-level apologetics book. Thank you very much for that review, whoever you are, Curious Guy. If you want to read more reviews, they're there at the Amazon page of the book. You can also find out more about the book, download a free sample chapter, even get hold of the audiobook as well from the Unbelievable book website, and signed copies of the book available there to purchase, and they'll be sent out to you as soon as possible. If you go there, unbelievablebook.co.uk is the place to go. Also, that bundle still available as well of the Unbelievable book and some DVDs as well at a special price if you want to take advantage of that. Again, unbelievablebook.co.uk. Later on today, Greg Kokel joins me on The Profile. That's in the first part of today's show between 4 and 5. And then Catherine Welby Roberts will also be talking to Ruth Jackson about her life and faith. She's the daughter of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. She does suffer from depression. She's going to be talking about the way that's impacted her faith, how she's dealt with that, and her new book as well. So if you want to listen to that, 4 till 5 today, or indeed listen via the podcast, increasingly popular, The Profile podcast, available via Podbean, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts from. And next week on the programme, it's going to be a special Christmas edition of Unbelievable. It'll just be a couple of days to go till Christmas Day next Saturday. And so we're going to be featuring on the programme Tylene Polly, creator of the Atheist Christmas album. She's going to be talking about why she created non-religious versions of classic Christmas carols. And she'll be in discussion with evangelist and Christian communicator Glenn Scrivener, who, as I mentioned last week, is one of the guests at this year's, well, next year's Unbelievable Conference 2018 on Saturday, the 19th of May. But Glenn's also been the man behind a wonderful online Christmas video series called Meet the Nativity, which if you haven't checked out yet, you really should. Go and check it out on Facebook or YouTube, or just type in Meet the Nativity, you'll find it. But they're going to be talking next week, Tylene, our atheist, Glenn, our Christian, on Christmas and the Atheist Christmas album. And we'll be hearing some of the songs that Tylene has created, of course, for that. Not much of your feedback this week, because we're making room for this interview I'm about to air with Jared McKenna. We will hear some of it next week because there was a lot of it, interest and appreciation for the discussion between Andrew Perriman, our New Testament historian, and Matt Hartke, who was a former Christian who lost his faith because of coming to believe that Jesus was a failed apocalyptic prophet. Here's some of the feedback to that next week. But I did get this handwritten letter from Andrew Nightingale. He's a former show guest. He's an agnostic. And he says, congratulations on writing your book while holding a job down. I take my hat off to you. And he says he wrote this letter, and apologies for the state of the writing, on his knee at an airport. He says letters are a bit of a victim of the social media, aren't they? But he wanted to do this. Says, very impressed with how you keep coming up with original topics on Unbelievable. Really enjoyed the recent Science Mike one. There's something very refreshing about people who can look unflinchingly at the problems of their worldview and the behaviour of some of its members. I've yet to discover a worldview without a few skeletons in the cupboard. I wanted to ask you if you had ever thought about why new atheists are so keen to get Christians to unbelieve in God. I remember you asking me if I ever felt like a project to my Christian friends and confess I couldn't bring myself to tell the truth on air for fear of hurting their feelings and losing their friendship. You must have experienced that moment when a friend pulls back once they realise that they're not going to convert you on one subject or another. I also wonder how transferable the lessons from talking about faith are to talking about Brexit or global warming. With 81% of white evangelicals voting for Trump, as well as the Roy Moore debacle, Democrats, of course, do put party before principle as well with Bill Clinton. Is it fair to say that the Christian right wing is in charge of the Christian brand and that this is what is turning people off? The rise of the spiritual but not religious suggests that people still have a personal faith but don't want to be told how to think and how to vote. I have an alternative version also of your atheist prayer experiment for you. Have Anglicans or semi-conservative Christians go to a very conservative church for 2 months, and also have friendly atheists go online and stick up for Christians being trolled by alt-atheists. I just made that term up. It's not a thing yet. Actually, the online thing would be easier to do, having Christians and atheists stick up for the other side's beliefs a week or so and then compare experiences. It's an easy way of loving your enemy. I've tried doing it myself, sticking up for conservative and woolly Christians, and couldn't have predicted the effect it had on how I saw atheism and Christianity afterwards. You conclude by saying, I'm sorry about the handwriting. It's bad anyway, but not helped by the fact I'm writing this on my knee at an airport. Anyway, thank you. I really appreciated your letter, Andrew, written in the traditional format, which very rarely comes across my desk these days. But do feel free to send in your thoughts about today's show via the normal method, email unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or indeed via our social media at unbelievablejb and facebook.com/unbelievablejb.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, it's time for something a bit different now. And with Christmas approaching fast, when we remember how the Holy Family became refugees on the run from a dictator, I thought it might be interesting to cover a little bit differently a social justice issue on the programme today. Jared McKenna is an Australian pastor and activist who's been taking a stand for a number of years against the Australian government's treatment of refugees and asylum seekers, mainly through non-violent protests and sit-ins. Well, he's a friend of the show, a listener actually, of the programme, and one of his most recent missions involved an undercover trip to Manus. It's a small island off the coast of Papua New Guinea, where Australia has been detaining male refugees indefinitely. Many of them have been there for up to 5 years. There are a number of alleged human rights abuses going on. There's also a strong Christian community among the refugees. So I began by asking Jared how his undercover mission to get on the island began.
Father Dave, who is famous in Sydney for being the boxing priest, he's actually the eldest professional Australian boxer. He works with at-risk youth and teaches boxing as a way of self-discipline and helping young people get off drugs and their lives together. He just sent out a message on Twitter and said, he tagged me in it, would you come with me? And I immediately said yes. As you know, Justin, I live with refugees. I've been pastoring churches where refugees have been a part of for over 15 years now. And so I immediately said yes. And through the help of others, we were able to fly to Papua New Guinea and then from Papua New Guinea get a smaller plane to Manus Island. And then we arrived at Manus itself, and I preached on Sunday. I spoke at a graduation of a seminary. And while we were there, we were also were able to enter the processing centre by being smuggled in.
The processing center then is on the island. There's a sort of indigenous community on the island itself, but the processing center also exists there alongside that. What's the situation there within the processing center itself?
Once we were smuggled in by boat, the same way that Ben Doherty from The Guardian and Damien from The New York Times was also smuggled in, under the beautiful stars, because there's no light pollution, so it's just glorious. Like the psalms just come up in your heart at the wonder of creation there. It's absolutely stunning, and yet we were arriving in this hellish location where when we arrived, it was 24th day since Australia had cut off all power, as in electricity, all food supplies, all medical supplies, including psychiatric drugs for people struggling with severe trauma for being A, leaving a war zone, B, for being locked up for nearly 5 years, but also cut off all water supply. And so we were smuggled in the same way as journalists, and what we saw was what you can imagine from people who have had to collect ingeniously off the roof water for wells to wash in. There were incredible skin conditions. When I was actually, we were trying to leave the island after, well, the centre after 7 hours of being in there and filming with a journalist, Olivia Rousseau, I cut my ankle when we were discovered by the Navy, whose floodlights hit us, and Father Dave made it onto the boat and was able to get away. We actually, Justin, had to run back into the centre, and ironically, as Australians, find refuge in the centre itself. And that was, it was like being born again for me. It's one of the most moving and incredible experiences of my life.
Extraordinary story. You did eventually, obviously, manage to get out. Part of, I suppose, this whole reason you were there was to be able to highlight what's going on. Give us an examples of the community that does exist there, but how they're being treated at present by the Australian authorities.
Yeah, and of course that has changed, because the men who were there were resisting going to the new centre, and the reason for that, you know, that a legion. One being that the centres aren't safe. They're in a location where refugees have been attacked previously. Two, the centres aren't finished. Like, literally, they were forced out after we left by the military into these new centres. And it's been well documented, and your listeners might have seen it on the BBC, that people have been bashed and these bruises and lacerations. And again, Justin, this is the tropics, so chances of infection are so incredibly high. But three, the main reason is this is a new centre to hide these men's reality and to muffle their cries for freedom and safety. And so they were refusing to go. So when we were there, we witnessed this dual reality of the incredible horror and yet this amazing, fragile hope. And if I may, Justin, just I think telling the story of how we were received by the men gives you a sense of who they are, how they're organising, and their incredible courage after what they've been through. Is that okay to share?
Yeah, please do. Go ahead.
So when we actually, when the floodlights hit us, the Navy's floodlights, it was incredibly disorientating. We were lost in the jungle between the water and the actual centre. I cut my ankle open on scrap metal from the military base, had left that there. Somebody said, "Brother, take my hand." His name was Adam, I learned later. This very tall young man, same age as my son. My son, in the last 5 years, he's, you know, finished high school and got into university. He's in his third year of university. He's met a special someone. He's saving up money with his friends for a trip to Japan. This young man, Adam, hasn't been able to do any of those things. He fled the genocide in Darfur. He lost people close to him and his home. And here's a situation where I have nowhere to go. He takes my hand, he leads me into the center. Then they see that the mud and the blood that we're covered in, and they wash our feet with the limited water, rainwater, that they had been collecting. And that action of having my feet washed by these men that Australia has rejected, not just rejected, but indefinitely imprisoned without end, and then them sharing, they took us to a safe location and they housed us. It's like they went through Matthew 25 and ticked every box. We were hungry. They shared their limited food resources, which the local churches had smuggled in. We were thirsty. They shared their limited water supply that the locals have smuggled in to support them. We were ill. I was cut, and they shared their limited medical supplies. We had no place to stay, and they made a room for us and put us up. They visited us, even though we were imprisoned with them, until we were able to get off the island the next night, where we actually had to swim 20 minutes out into the ocean, which I've since found out by somebody who used to live there that it's crocodile infested, and we didn't know that at the time. But this is the kind of miracles that we saw that were in there, miracles of compassion from these people. And I've never experienced such humiliating compassion, not humbling, but humiliating, because I was so aware that everything these men had shown me, this gospel witness that I was on the receiving end from, is everything that my nation had not given to them. And so the strange reality that in terms of the sheep and the goats, that, you know, passage that was read in many churches this last Sunday, Australia as a nation, and the parable is addressed to nations, is on the wrong side, while these men that we at the moment aren't even acting in a way that we're worthy of are on the other side, and yet we're shutting Christ out of our nation on this island.
Yeah, and it's just an interesting one, isn't it, that when Jesus gives that parable, he is speaking to the nations specifically. He obviously holds nations accountable for the way they treat people. Your story is just incredible, but in a sense is what these men are living with and as a daily reality. Jared, I did see shortly after you had managed to make your escape that there was a situation that arose whereby, as far as I could see from the reports that you were sharing, a number of supplies that had been given to these men were trashed by the authorities in Manus. Do you want to just fill us in on what happened there?
Yeah, after we left, the local police, which Tim Costello, Reverend Tim Costello, who's Australia's most respected public figure, Australia's Reader's Digest actually voted him the man that most Australians would like to see as our Prime Minister. Tim, of course, has been head of World Vision Australia for many years. Tim went on a humanitarian investigation of what's happening there, and he has called this a humanitarian crisis. And Tim was actually there while it was happening. I left the day just before, but the men were beaten and forced out of the centre onto buses into New Centre, which is not yet finished. And their supplies and their new kind of camp, which is hard to describe in ways that don't sound romanticised, but really, my experience, Justin, was it was like the early church. They were sharing all in common. They had even appointed deacons to care for the sick in the camp, to take around people with mental illnesses, to look at the birds so they could do better in those horrific conditions. And now under the Australian government's commandment, if you will, Tim Costello was saying they've been forced out into these new centres which aren't finished in another attempt to hide the reality of this under these policies that seek to dissuade people leaving war-torn situations from coming to Australia. And people are celebrating that Australia has quote-unquote stopped the boats. But stopping the boats, Justin, celebrating that is like celebrating boarding up windows of a burning building so people can't jump out of them. The question is, how do we put out the flames and how do we actually make a safe exit for these people in this situation? And at the moment, my nation needs that kind of moral leadership where we're actually relating to one another as children of God, everybody made in the image of God, not as political footballs to be kicked around, these vulnerable people.
I mean, generally speaking, Australians pride themselves on their sort of progressive social attitudes and that kind of thing. Yet happening under their noses is this totalitarian almost treatment of people in order to, as you say, send out this message to make people not want to come, as it were.
Justin, you're spot on. I was joking with a friend yesterday that Kiwis, that is New Zealanders, we affectionately call them Kiwis in Australia, they're everything Australia presents itself to be, but we're not. And by that, I mean that the New Zealand government has actually offered to take some of these men. And to understand just how punitive the Australian government is being, they've said no to other nations taking these men who are found to be genuine refugees and resettling them because they're fearful it will put, quote-unquote, sugar on the table for other refugees to seek safety in Australia. That is how... it's diabolical. And in terms of like praying through Australia's history and repenting of that history, you're right, Australians, we do, we value and pride ourselves on a fair go of it being a place which is just for everyone. And yet part of the dark history of Australia is that one of the first laws passed in Australian Parliament in 1901 was the White Australia Policy. So it is a fair go for all, as long as you're white. And in Australian history, white has basically been defined as British. So pubs in Australia used to have signs that said, no blacks, no dogs, no Chinamen, no Irish.
Wow.
And this is the history that needs to be repented of. This is the history that we need to name and actually weep over, ask for forgiveness for, so Australia can like actually become everything God has purposed us to be in Christ. And it's a difficult thing because people automatically think you're talking about politics. But this isn't a right and left issue. It's a right and wrong issue. It's about responding as people under the Lordship of Christ, taking our baptism seriously, and living into Christ's compassion in ways that are prophetic, where people can see what Australia could be, what our nations could be, if we were obedient to the love that Christ has shown us.
And whether you're a Christian or not, to most people, surely it can just be seen as a human rights issue. I mean, these people are not being treated as humans in their own right. They're being used as means to an end to basically be this kind of deterrent, as it were. But their own lives are in the process, obviously, just being completely ransacked.
Spot on. And you know me, I'm a God botherer. I'm a pastor. I'm a preacher. I'm going to frame it out of my story so it's true to me. But even in just the general Western sense of ethics, this is Kant's imperative, that people aren't a means, they're an end in themselves. That is to say that we can't use people or sacrifice people for some greater good. So a system that says we are going to punish 600 innocent people en masse, so for the greater good, supposedly, I think it's actually a lie, of people not coming and seeking safety in Australia, even just your decent, secular, Western person would say, that is horrible, that is horrific, and doesn't value the dignity of every human being.
You've been arrested a few times yourself in the past, Jared. You kind of got away without being arrested this time round, but you say that other pastors recently have been arrested. What's the latest protest that took place, and what were they protesting?
Yeah, I have been trained by the people who were co-workers with Martin Luther King, so I'm very much in the tradition of Jim Lawson, Vincent Harding, Martin Luther King and the Freedom Movement, and that tradition of Christian nonviolence we've employed here in Australia over the last 3-4 years with the Love Makes a Way movement, where we've actually seen over 300 Christian leaders arrested, calling for people who have been indefinitely held in detention to be released into safety. And Monday we took maybe the most drastic actions we've taken yet, and some people will be familiar with theologian and missiologist Michael Frost, and others will be familiar with Father Rod Boyer, or climate ethicist, Christian ethicist Byron Smith, and an amazing young woman named Hoover, who herself is a Christian refugee. We were locked on with chains to the front doors of what is symbolically the house of, I guess it's our White House, it's the home of our Prime Minister. and doing so, locked on and attached ourselves to the cause of these men. And we refused to leave until these men find safety, realizing that it would mean us being arrested, which we were. And it has caused an incredible Christ-like fuss in Australia, where people are actually asking the questions. When we have clergy who are having to take such drastic actions just to call out the fact that we are being inhumane and forgetting the humanity of those seeking safety, what have we become? And so Love Makes a Way has more actions planned the rest of this week, with people from Baptist, Pentecostal, Charismatic, Catholic, Anglican, I mean, you name it. Like, if we were to talk theology, other than Christ, there's not much we would agree on. But what we're all on the same page of is this, that Jesus is found in the stranger, in the refugee, and we as Australians can't continue to reject these people. We actually have to lead the way in compassion.
If people want to kind of do something, maybe they don't feel like, you know, it's a long way away on a, you know, a remote island off the coast of Australia, what can they do practically, as well as pray, obviously, if they're Christians and they want to do that, that's really important. But is there anything else that they can also do, Jared?
Yeah, please pray. Even if you're not a Christian, please pray. I think it works anyway. But in your prayers, not the kind of thoughts and prayers that, you know, we see on Twitter, but the kind of prayer that moves us into compassionate, costly action. You know, our Pommy mates, we love you and you love us. You've got many friends in Australia. Ask them, what's happening? Do you know this? Share the interview with them. Encourage them to contact their local politicians. Encourage them to meet with them. Maybe go to the Love Makes Away website and send that to your friends. Please help Australia be the compassionate people we could be, because these current policies of these last governments are actually wrecking that reputation and leading the world in cruelty. It was very disturbing to us that Donald Trump has actually sent people to come and learn from these policies that we are implementing. We need to be so much better than this. We have been so much better than this. So I encourage your listeners to encourage their Aussie mates to step into being informed, being compassionate, and taking nonviolent action.
Well, look, my prayers go with you. Keep being a holy disturber out there, Jared. And and thank you so much for being with me on the line today.
Thanks, brother.
That was Jared McKenna. What a remarkable person. All power to your elbow, Jared. Follow him on Twitter at Jared McKenna. You can find him on Facebook at facebook.com/JaredAndMates. And you can also check out his First Home project as well if you go online. Thank you for listening to today's show. Coming up next, The Profile with Greg Kokel and Catherine Welby Roberts. But let me tell you what's coming up on this program next week.
You're unbelievable.
Tylene Polly, creator of the Atheist Christmas album, will be talking about why she's created non-religious versions of classic Christmas carols. She'll be talking to evangelist and Christian communicator Glenn Scrivener. See you for our Christmas edition of the program next week. You've been listening to The Unbelievable Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcasting software, and find out more about our other Premier podcasts at premier.org.uk/podcasts.